You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, Michael.
Hello, Bob.
How are you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
I can't complain. Let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright. This is The Wright Show, available on both streaming video and by audio podcast. Should you choose to subscribe, an option available to you, in fact, Michael, in the future, should you decide to subscribe once you have been featured on The Wright Show?
I'll take it under advisement.
Okay. It depends on whether this turns out to be an experience you want to remember or an experience you want to forget.
I'm hopeful.
Okay. Me too. I'm very optimistic. I actually am very interested in this conversation because you're one of these people on Twitter. The whole this election has a much more complex ecosystem in the world of like pundits and opinion makers than is usually the case. Usually there's like people on one side and people on the other. But you, at least to judge by your Twitter involvement, I would say what you come off as is definitely anti-Hillary, not necessarily pro-Trump.
I would say that's a fair statement.
At least that's your Twitter persona. How would you describe your ideology? You're a writer. You write for the Daily Beast, the Daily News, and you've written for the American Conservative, and we may allude to pieces in all of these places. Do you write for Vice too, or what? Do you have a primary affiliation?
Informally or formally, advice as columnist. I kind of cite that as my primary affiliation, but it's not, it's set in any kind of stone, really.
Okay.
But it's funny, you mentioned how would I describe myself, and it's interesting to hear you attempt your own description of me based on what you can glean from my Twitter and I guess some of my writings, just because, framing oneself in terms of the current presidential election is a dicey prospect, right? Because you have to do it in relation to whatever the popular conceptions of Hillary and Trump in this case are. And I think, when that's the task before you, if you don't want to pigeon yourself as exclusively anti-Trump or pro-Trump or anti-Hillary or pro-Hillary, I don't know. It seems like it's complicating in terms of one's self-description.
Mm-hmm.
But you mentioned I think I am fairly characterized as anti-Trump, and that's sort of a shorthand way of putting that I feel the popular prevailing, especially liberal and also elite conservative, reaction to Trump has been in equal parts hysterical, irrational, incoherent, suggestive of certain pathologies within those two ideological cohorts. So I feel...
But from that, you have no objection to it, aside from all those things.
Right. I don't support Trump, right? So I'm not in a position that can be easily necessarily categorized.
Well, had you traditionally described yourself as liberal or conservative or none of the above?
I would broadly situate myself probably more on the left than the right, but I don't think...
Because one could guess that you're... an aggrieved, I don't want to use that in a judgmental or negative way, but an aggrieved Bernie supporter.
Well, I've made no bones about saying on Twitter and other public fora that, I did vote for Bernie Sanders in the Democratic primary, and I supported his candidacy for what it was worth. My central identity is not as a Bernie supporter. It was someone who determined that Bernie was the optimal candidate in this particular election.
But cycle. you're more left than right.
I mean, I would say that's broadly true,
Okay, so... you've described the reaction to Trump as hysterical and so on. What are good examples of egregious hysteria?
Well, the most egregious hysteria, I think, in terms of both its internal incoherence and the potential damage that it could have on the country, is the Russia hysteria. And I think I've heard you mention this maybe in a previous episode, but the long-term ramifications of the Democratic, now orthodoxy, on Russia is not only, I think, tainting the Syria conflict, which is probably at a nadir right now, it's also going to have future implications for diplomatic accord between the United States and Russia. Putin is likely to be in office for the foreseeable future. And it seems now that, the relationship between the United States and Russia has reached a low point probably not seen since the mid-80s, maybe even earlier. I think the rhetoric of the Democratic presidential nominee, who, after all, is the representative not just of the incumbent party, but of basically the political establishment. So Trump is not embraced by the current political establishment. He's rejected in large part. So she's kind of this bipartisan emblem now of what the consensus view in U.S. politics is. And for her to have adopted this line about Russia, where, her top surrogates will freely call Russia a dictatorship. Putin is a dictator now. Actually, Tim Kaine in this
week. Well, he is kind of a dictator, right? He's an authoritarian leader.
Authoritarian leader, I would agree with. Right. I don't know I would use the word dictator. He has some democratic mandate, right? I don't think I'm not, and this is the part of why I'm in an awkward position. And some people that I've been, been talking about this with are in an awkward position, is because I don't have any brief for Putin.
Right.
Far from it. If I was a Russian, I would probably be in the opposition to Putin, right? But I'm now there's now a scenario domestically in the United States where if you kind of just buy into whatever the dominant view of Putin is, you're buying into this hysteria, which I think frames him in a way that is not accurate out of pure political expediency, because it's seen as a way to damage Trump. You know, and you know, the single most repeated message by Hillary Clinton from around early August to maybe mid or early September of this year was that Trump was somehow a puppet of Putin, and that the word puppet was actually used. So that's really retrograde. I mean, her campaign manager went on national TV and said he was a puppet of Putin, and for some reason this is just accepted as normal.
I mean, I kind of sympathize with your, you know, it's funny, when this was just getting underway, this meme about, you know, Trump being a tool of Putin's, I remember on Twitter, somebody, it was either Josh Marshall or Michael Cohen or somebody, linking to something about Trump's business connections with Russia and probably about the, what's his name, Manafort's connections via Ukraine or whatever. And they said, why is this, at that point it hadn't caught on in a big way, they were pushing the meme, and the question was, why is this not caught on? And I was tempted to reply, I never did, but like, maybe because it plays on the kind of xenophobia that you object to when Trump employs it, broadly speaking, xenophobia broadly speaking. It's of course different to say, there's a difference between saying, here come the Mexican hordes, and saying the evil Vladimir Putin, you know, is doing X, Y, and Z, but I did feel that there was that kind of paradox in playing that card against Trump. So I kind of sympathize with that. I mean, I haven't gone as far as you have, but we'll get into that. I mean, in my overall sympathies, but there is that. Now you, and this is something you're hearing from other people, I guess you would say on the left, Glenn Greenwald has been very critical of them playing the Putin card and so on. I mean, partly because it so clearly echoes like the 50s and McCarthyism, you know.
And it's no, just to interject quickly, it's no longer an echo. I mean, there's now a group funded by these Democratic donors. So Democracy Alliance is this group of liberal, wealthy donors who generally fund, you know, standard fare Democratic Party causes. Mm-hmm. And they put out this, I believe it's a PAC, I have to double check, but it's some kind of advocacy group where they have a website, PutinTrump.org. I have to, you know, double check the mm-hmm. precise language. But, you know, transposed onto these sinister images of Putin and Trump is the hammer and sickle. So that's not echo. I mean, and mm-hmm. people, you know, one of the standard rebuttals to whenever people of my ilk, so to say, raise these objections is, well, Russia's no longer communist. So there's no way that you could red bait or you could scaremonger in these traditionally, you know, Russophobic ways, as we're seeing during the Soviet era. And, you know, that is true. That's why, you know, most people who I think are fair-minded about this have labeled the current tendency neo-McCarthyite, because, as you said, it echoes past tactics. Mm-hmm. But now, with this hammer and sickle transposition, it's no longer simply an echo. It's like a mirror image of it.
Yeah. No, people have been remarkably slow to grasp the demise of communism. I mean, like, you see the same thing with China. Now, it's true that it's still called the Communist Party in China, but there's nothing communist about it. They've totally given up on communism in China. It's very authoritarian, but that's a different... and it's very statist, the economy, but that's still not communism. Anyway, okay, so there's that. Now, you wrote a piece in the American Conservatism about why, as you put it, at least in the headline, movement conservatives are rooting for Hillary. Now, this is interesting because when I think of this particular meme, the anti-Russia meme, I think of neoconservatives, mm-hmm. who aren't exactly the same as movement conservatives. I mean, they may be part of the movement, the coalition that existed before Trump. But when I think of movement conservatives, I also, you know, I think of like evangelicals and conservatives on the social issues and so on. And I guess it wasn't so clear to me that movement conservatives, in that sense, have really deserted Trump big time. In fact, I think it couldn't be that all of them have, for him to have as much support as he seems to have in the polls. It is very clear that neoconservatives, it seems to me, have deserted Trump, and they are all in with Hillary, and it's a completely unified message with very few exceptions there. But is it the case that kind of non-neocon movement conservatives have deserted Trump en masse and really embraced Hillary? Because they hate Hillary, don't they?
Well, they do hate Hillary, and that's why I say they're rooting for Hillary. So they may not actively come out and endorse Hillary, mm-hmm. but I think that they perceive it as in their self-interest for Trump to lose. And I would draw a distinction between voters who might be under the movement conservative umbrella and help to... and whose votes have helped enshrine the movement conservative apparatus in Washington versus the elite members of the apparatus in Washington whose professional futures are based on the perpetuation of the Reagan
and
coalition.
And name some names. Who are some key elites here?
Well, you know, I think, you know, just look at the major think tanks. I mean, so Heritage Foundation, American Enterprise Institute. I don't want to name specific names without having their full quotes right in front of me. That's why I was more speaking in general terms in this piece. But, you know, I've been able to, I think, infer from just in general terms that this is what they want to happen.
Right.
And it's not that they have this newfound fondness for Hillary, obviously, because she's been their dire enemy for decades now.
Right.
But the point is that were Trump to be elected, it would necessitate a realignment, whereas it would no longer be no longer be tenable for the movement conservative apparatus as currently constituted to persist as it has since Reagan. So there would inevitably have to be a organized kind of semi-official conservative opposition to Trump, probably led by someone like Ted Cruz or Tom Cotton or whoever wants to, you know, desert him at some point. And you know, that in totality would lessen the overall power that the movement conservative apparatus has, because it would constantly be racked by these internecine fights, as we saw, you know, on display during the Republican primary this year. I don't think that wouldn't go away under a Trump presidency. I think it would continue. And you'd see a lot of them ending up having to align with the Democrats who are going to be in the opposition to Trump. So I think, you know, they can see the writing on the wall that that would be the scenario, I think, if under a Trump administration. And for that reason, just even just out of pure self-preservation instinct, they don't want to have to deal with that, because it would be easy for them to revert to their decades-old instinct of just being the opponents of Clinton, right? And it would actually unite what had been a fractured Republican coalition under the rubric of, you know, laying it all on the field to, you know, to stop whatever Hillary's agenda is. So I think, you know, that's a pretty straightforward, from my perspective, reading of what the current landscape is. And, you know, it has nothing to do with fondness for Hillary. It just has to do with the perception of Trump posing a greater threat to the movement conservative apparatus than Hillary would. And, you know, by extension, it would, you know, cost them money and clients and so on and so forth.
Yeah. And in a sense, I guess some of these think tanks are trying to hold themselves together in the sense that they have consisted of elements, you know, drawn from different parts of the conservative coalition. So, I mean, AEI is very has been very heavily neocon, but has also tried to appeal to, you know, various other parts of the conservative coalition. And I guess if, you know, if Trump wins, they might have some tough choices to make, I guess, maybe. I mean, that sense that these think tanks are almost trying to hold themselves together in a certain sense?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, under a Clinton administration, they would pretty clearly be able to hold themselves together as they had been under the Obama administration or the Bush administration. But Trump, because he kind of is a divergence from the... Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, but at the same time, I mean, some elements of the coalition are more Hillary-friendly than others. I mean, I think of neoconservatives, I think they've always kind of liked Hillary. It's not just as an alternative to Trump, because there's always been a fine line between liberal interventionism and neoconservatism. And I'd say Hillary's a good example of how fine the line is. So they've never had real issues with her. Whereas if you look at, like, the evangelical part of the conservative coalition, they hate Hillary, and they have substantive differences with her on things like abortion. So that's why I try to draw that contrast. I mean, it seems to me that, okay, you can talk about elites who have evangelicals as part of their base, but the evangelicals themselves, I imagine them supporting Hillary only in a very grudging fashion, whereas neoconservatives I can see having a long and happy, you know, 8 years of symbiosis with her.
Yeah, I agree with that. I don't see evangelicals' hatred of Hillary lessening at all, and probably only, you know, be amplified. But the point is that, you know, the differing view of Hillary, I think whatever the differences are among the factions of the conservative movement in their view of Hillary, those could be papered over by, generally speaking, an overall opposition to Hillary and a desire to put in a Republican president at the next available opportunity, right? Whereas under Trump, I would see Republican voters, you know, in the heartland, by and large, would fervently support Trump as president and want to support his agenda. Whereas in Washington, D.C., you could see whatever the fault lines are between the conservative elites and the voters who sustain them would be increasingly exposed under a Trump presidency, because they'd have to navigate that internal dynamic, I think, in a much starker way than they would if Hillary were president. Does that make sense?
And I think that's the conventional wisdom is, well, certainly if you look at the Republican Party as the institution in question, that if Trump loses, the Republican Party may be able to get through this in much the shape it was in. I mean, obviously paying more attention to the needs of white working class going forward, but still stay fundamentally intact. Whereas if Trump wins, it's going to be a very different Republican Party after him, is the conventional thinking.
Oh, I think, you know, I think that's actually correct. I think it would beget some kind of foundational realignment in the composition of the party that could be forestalled were Hillary to win. So if Trump loses, there's obviously going to be a whole battery of really sober-minded panel discussions about what Trumpism wrought, right? And there's going to be, I would say, probably superficial attempts to address Trumpism within the context of the kind of, you know, ordinary Republican Party orthodoxies. But I don't think anything fundamental would change, really. I mean, I think they would try to put on the appearance of fundamentally altering their ways. But, you know, unless they're forced into it, which Trump winning would do, I don't see them undertaking any kind of thoroughgoing change in the way that their party is structured.
Well, I think you might see some changes on immigration. I don't know. But you're right. It's challenging because the business class that a lot of the Republican money comes from doesn't seem to want to see big changes doesn't want to see a big closing of the borders.
And if Trump were to lose, it would be seen as a repudiation of his hard line on immigration. So they would just kind of keep whatever the elite preferences are as the top.
Yeah, they might be. You know, if Trump loses, I mean, two things are going to happen. I mean, first of all, he may well start Trump TV, which is going to keep his movement alive. And by the way, it's going to exert competitive pressure on Fox to become even crazier than it is. Crazy, that's my term, maybe not yours. But
I'm more crazy.
yeah, right. But you know what I mean. I mean, regardless of your view on immigration, I just mean, more inflammatory, more fear-mongering, more XYZ. So there's that. And then also, you know, the people like Ted Cruz are paying attention. And they're asking themselves, well, look, obviously there's a legacy here that somebody that I wouldn't mind inheriting. A lot of people voted for Donald Trump. What do I have to do? What changes can I make that maximize the base I have going forward? And I think you're going to see some, it'll be interesting to see what kinds of positions Republican politicians take. So I think I'm partly saying it's not as if it's going to be easy for the Republican Party to stay fundamentally intact and recognizable, even if Trump loses. But one thing that I think doesn't get discussed enough is that what Trump signifies, I think, is a challenge for the Democratic Party as well. I mean, there are tensions within the Democratic coalition as well. I mean, you know, you could make the argument that African Americans in the working class should themselves be skeptical of immigration, but because, you know, there's competition for labor there. That hasn't really happened in a big way. And for that matter, it's not as if the Democratic Party is totally devoid of people in the white working class. I mean, they're still associated with some labor unions and so on. And so you might imagine that going forward, there's tension within the Democratic Party on the issue of immigration. Bernie Sanders seems to have highlighted tension on the issue of trade. So it's far from clear to me that the Republican Party is the only party that could change substantially going forward.
Oh, I totally agree with that. And, you know, one of my main journalistic endeavors over the past however many months now is to highlight these tensions in the Democratic coalition that had been, I think, obscured or consciously ignored by the punditocracy, because the tensions within the Republican coalition have been, I don't know, so outrageous or even cartoonish in certain ways. So they've sucked up most of the attention. You know, but as I wrote in a Daily Beast article that came out a couple days ago, the divisions that the Democratic primary made plain might be more electorally consequential for the nominee than the divisions of the Republican Party. Because, you know, the inclination or the tendency among Republicans who are, you know, and I don't mean to be judgmental by saying this, but who are more authoritarian minded, who are more deferential to authority, you know, their tendency is to fall in line behind whoever their party puts forward as the nominee. I mean, that's just, I think, their disposition of the voters, generally speaking. Whereas for the, you know, on the left, you know, there's an ingrained aversion to authority, at least among the more activist elements of the left coalition, right? So there's going to be a greater reluctance, especially among the more fervent Bernie people, to just toss aside all the reservations that they had about Hillary that they had been propounding for the duration of the campaign and likely before the 2016 campaign, and just, you know, reconcile themselves to Hillary and in the continuation of the status quo as represented by her in their opinion. And this is really ironic, right? Because the media fixation on Trump as a problem for intra-party relations among Republicans was the object of just endless media fascination for so long, right? But what ended up happening, you know, is that I think the Sanders candidacy portended something much more enduring in terms of the composition of the Democratic Party coalition. And I don't think that's gotten sufficient attention. And, you know, I'm writing something now, and I think, you know, that bears on this line of inquiry, which is that, you know, there was just this constant avalanche of analysis as to what pathologies led to the Republicans nominating such an unpopular and unqualified candidate, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, fair question. I think that should be investigated. And it has been, right? But there has not been really much investigation at all into how the Democratic Party ended up nominating someone who is also historically unpopular. Is viewed as even less trustworthy than Trump among voters age 34 and younger. And who is constantly racked by scandal upon scandal. I mean, you could argue about the degree of severity of any given scandal. I tend to think that Democrats, out of partisan interest, downplayed the severity of the email scandal. And, you know, the emails referring to the scandal as the emails is a trivialization of it, I think. I mean, the emails are government records, right? And they were destroyed. And, you know, the public has a right to view them, and the media has a right to obtain them. And, you know, the lies, and there were many outright lies that went into Hillary's explanation of what happened to those emails, I think, are incontrovertible. It's incontrovertible that they are lies, right? So, but this all is to say that, you know, what pathologies in the Democratic coalition led to the historic coalescence around this particular candidate, mm-hmm. Despite all her obvious flaws, and you know, a lot of Democratic operatives and politicos were very cognizant of these flaws too, all along the way, but they went along with it anyway. They crowded out other candidates. So mm-hmm. Elizabeth Warren was crowded out. Joe Biden was crowded out. Only little old Bernie Sanders was really left to run. He ended up upstaging her to a fairly significant degree and got something like 43% of the pledged delegates. Mm-hmm. This notwithstanding virtually every elected official in the country who's a Democrat mm-hmm. endorsing Hillary, and every Democratic machine
Plus, he's a socialist. You traditionally, socialists don't do well in national politics in America. But at the same time, I do think it is inherently less mystifying how you wind up with a Hillary than how you wind up with a Trump, just in the sense that even if I grant that they're equally flawed, and of course they do both, they are the two least popular candidates, at least in the sense of having the highest unfavorables in the history of American presidential elections since polling on that question began. So they're both, and there are, Hillary is flawed in some other ways. You could argue about the severity of the scandals, but... you know, she doesn't naturally connect with people in the way you would like, and she has a tendency to say things like basket of deplorables and baked chocolate chip cookies and things that just, you know, are not...
Rub people the wrong way.
Yeah. At the same time, A, how she got here is plainly intelligible. She's part of a political dynasty. She had this amazing political resume. She's super smart. She actually cares about policy. There's a reason to think she actually has ideological proclivities. Trump is the likes of which we have never seen in a national presidential election. So I'm not surprised. I mean, come on. If 2 years ago somebody had said to you, Donald Trump will be the Republican nominee, what kind of odds would you have taken on that bet, right?
I wouldn't have made the bet.
Okay. So it's just, it's more mystifying. And I think it is more troubling in the sense that, and, you know, maybe I'm like old and old fashioned and everything, but, you know, this is just a standard indictment of Trump. You've heard it. I mean, he's just plain old. Let's start at the less grave end of it. He's just a jerk. He's just so transparently, conspicuously, and unabashedly a jerk in a way that I thought Americans did not like. I was wrong. Apparently, you can be, you know, like Donald Trump and have a considerable following. I just would have thought most Americans would say, no, that degree of egotism just rubs me the wrong way. I would have thought that. There's the crudeness of, you know, the personal insults and the degrading insults in some cases. There's the famous mocking of a disabled person. There are the, you know, the dog whistles, the bigotry. There's all the stuff you've heard. I mean, so I do think there's more reason to go, wait a second. When somebody like him catches on, we really need to evaluate what the source of that is. And here I agree with you. We should be doing more of that and less just denouncing him. I mean, I know I just spent a lot of time denouncing him, but I don't actually spend a lot of time just calling him a racist, because I'm more interested in figuring out what the source of his support is. But still, I mean, don't you agree that there's a sense in which he is a more troubling sign than Hillary is? Or at least maybe it's that Hillary is a troubling sign in a much more traditional and hallowed American sense, right? So she's a politician, she's got scandals, she's got X, Y, and Z, but they're all things we've seen before, right?
Yeah, I basically agree with everything you just said there. And I would, you know, obviously concede, or it's not even a concession, I would, you know, freely acknowledge that Trump winning the Republican nomination especially is something unlike anything we've seen before in modern electoral politics. Right. So yeah, therefore, I think, you know, rightly, I think warrants some intense scrutiny and analysis and everything else, and even some denunciation. You know, I always make sure to clarify that I do not support Trump, and I freely denounce Trump and his a number of his proposals, especially the, you know, Muslim ban, which I think is his most notoriously, you know, repugnant proposal. And the fact that he's, I think, normalized that as a tenable, you know, policy response to Muslim fanaticism, so far as it exists, I think is really obnoxious.
Well, just
go ahead.
I was just going to say he has normalized, he's helping to normalize a number of objectionable things, I think. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, I agree with that, and I think that should be looked at seriously in terms of what it says about the polity.
Right.
But at the same time, I feel like, you know, you just went through, I think, the standard litany of the things that people find objectionable about Trump. Mm-hmm. And what was it that you focused on just there, right? It was that he's made a lot of crude remarks about people, often some minorities, mm-hmm. Women, and so forth, right? And this is what Tim Kaine focused on in the most recent vice presidential debate. You know, obviously his focus group tested strategy was to try to barrage Mike Pence as much as possible with these various mm-hmm. remarks, right? And so the idea is that, you know, Trump is too crass to be the president. And I think there's a way, I mean, or he's too, you know, he's made too many rude jokes.
It's way beyond crass precisely because it is directed not just at individuals, but groups of people. So it gets into, bigotry and the normalization of and seeming legitimization of more bigoted discourse.
Yeah, so granting that, there's also a heavy focus on his insults of particular individuals. So even now, people will raise his calling Rosie O'Donnell like a fat pig or whatever it was, yeah, as if that's supposed to make us all, you know, recoil in horror that in some kind of lighthearted context in 2005, he called a comedian a slob, right? So, you know, and so that's just one example of, I think, of an inordinate focus on the crudeness of Trump.
That's a politically motivated attempt to highlight misogyny per se, mm-hmm. and it's, you know, it's coming out of Hillary camp. I get why tactically I agree. It's not the most troubling thing about, and I also agree he'd say the same thing about a man. I think they're, you know, they're trying to play up as much as possible misogyny per se. I understand that tactically. It's not now the crudeness in general though does bother me. It just degrades our political discourse. It's just And, you know, I think we face a growing problem of just bitter political polarization that is starting to kind of cripple the nation. So I do not applaud people who turn the Republican debates into an insult contest and then turn the general election into an insult contest. I don't.
But then the counterpoint to that, or the corollary, is that it would somehow be better, or would somehow be more indicative of virtue if, you know, this receptivity to crudeness was somehow suppressed and it wasn't in the political arena, right? And the Republican debates, or the nominee, was a little more staid, a little more Romney-esque, and, you know, polite. And somehow this would be what? I mean, this would be a salve. I don't really understand what people think that would bring to the table that would be so much better than Trump. And this isn't any defense of Trump's crass behavior, right? It's just that I don't think that crassness, to whatever degree it's a problem or objectionable, should be so central to the analysis of what Trump represents. So on any given day, you're overrun with whatever his latest barb is. And if it was put in a kind of like a jokey, crude, insulting way, it's going to be dominating the punditocracy chatter for the next 24 hours. And I think just the obsession and the fixation with it is just disproportionate to me. And I wish that there was a greater – I mean, with the average voter over the past 2 weeks would probably know, you know, so far as they're, you know, abreast of the political process, they would probably know that Trump went on this like late night Twitter rant about Miss Universe, right?
Right.
By the way, it has to be the most vapid political controversy of I don't know how long.
Well, it does. But let me ask you, like, if you transplant all of this into an actual Trump presidency where the people he's talking about include world leaders, and you imagine a guy who at 3 a.m. goes on a Twitter tirade, that doesn't trouble you?
No, I mean, it does. It troubles me.
Okay, so it's a legitimate question then.
Sure, it's legitimate. I'm just saying there's a disproportionate focus on things of that nature. I'm not saying to ignore it. I'm saying to just properly and, I don't know, sober-mindedly assess it rather than have that be the central feature of what you take to be Trumpism.
I don't
think it warranted a week of breathless coverage, let's put it that way. But the exclusion of other issues.
Isn't it a gravely concerning feature of an American president that the kinds of stuff he...
But the people who find that gravely concerning, for example, won't find it gravely concerning that Hillary Clinton has overtly threatened war against Russia.
I'm afraid I can disprove your thesis. You just said the people who find that gravely concerning about Trump won't find that gravely concerning about Hillary. You are looking at someone who finds both things gravely concerning.
You're an anomaly, Bob. That's why we love you.
Well, I mean, look, Hillary's foreign policy troubles me very deeply.
Just to finish that point for a second. So the people who are very gravely concerned and want everyone to line up in the outrage brigade about the Miss Universe tweet, they will either say that it doesn't matter or ignore or try to rationalize Hillary's overt threats of war against a nuclear armed power Russia, right? Yep. So, and she has done this. I can give you the quote. It's an August 31st speech she gave in Cincinnati, Ohio, where she said that just a cyber attack. So she referenced the supposed Russian cyber attack on the Democratic National Committee. Mm-hmm. She said that specific attack could rise to the level of import that it would bring about some kind of American military retaliation against Russia, right? So that just fell by the wayside. Very few people paid any attention to it. But those same people, and I'm speaking in broad terms, obviously, mm-hmm. because, you know, obviously you might not have this tendency, or, you know, people who are a little more attuned to these things. But the people who spend every day outraged about stuff like Miss Universe, which I think is generally pretty trivial. Yeah, it is concerning that Trump could be on Twitter and kind of spark some kind of diplomatic crisis. I'm not going to discount that as something to be concerned about. But then why isn't there any commensurate concern about like the Democratic nominee threatening to initiate a full-scale military confrontation with nuclear-armed Putin and ruining the diplomatic relationship between the United States and that country for the foreseeable future? I mean, so it just seems like there's a disparity here between the level of
Let me pause and interject. I mean, did you say she threatened war in response to cyber attacks?
Yeah.
Okay, I just want to pause and interject that it was the United States that carried cyber warfare to a wholly new level.
Yeah.
With Stuxnet, where we used cyber attacks to actually blow stuff up. That, you can argue about whether conventional cyber attacks are an act of war, but when you blow stuff up, in this case centrifuges, you know, like disable them physically, that's an act of war. So I'm just like totally on board with your critique here. But at the same time, I mean, here's my issue.
She said that a cyber attack against American cyber infrastructure should be treated just as gravely and just as seriously in terms of warranting some kind of military response as a conventional attack on American physical infrastructure.
I think that's virtually a matter of American doctrine now. There was some report that came out of some Pentagon agency, like, I don't know, 8 years ago or so, that virtually said that. It was the language was maybe mildly ambiguous, but the point was to say we reserve the right.
She's gone farther than Obama has.
Yeah. Oh yeah. But look, Obama, and I forget if she was Secretary of State, but Obama brought a Stuxnet, and he will have that to live down forever, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, we should be doing exactly the opposite. We should be trying to establish a normative and legal structure that discourages cyber warfare, and we've been doing exactly the opposite. But let me tell you, the problem I have here is, like, okay, granted, I find Hillary's foreign policy dangerous. She just hasn't gotten the idea that regime change backfires. It backfired in Iraq, backfired in Libya, and yet still in Syria, that's her goal. And it's been our goal for a long time. But that said, so it would be one thing if Trump were some kind of principled alternative to that, right? Like if he had this long history of like well-considered non-interventionism, I mean, especially if, in my book at least, especially if that was wedded with a commitment to nurturing international law and global governance in ways that would make conflict less likely and blah, blah, blah. I'd love all that. But I think the most troubling thing about Trump is he has no actual convictions. And one way, a good example of this, by the way, is like, okay, you could say he's, it'd be great if he was a non-interventionist, but it's politically expedient to say certain quite non-interventionist things right now. And when it is, he says those. And he says he's against the Iran deal was terrible and he'll do something about it. You know, the point is, he's just completely opportunistic, it seems. You know, he'll bomb ISIS and take their oil. I just think the guy has no actual thought out ideology. And his sole goal is to get as much attention as possible. Not even as much power, which is usually the problem with politicians. Just as much people paying attention to him at any given moment as is possible. I think that's his overriding goal. So I'm just saying, like, I would love to have some kind of actual preferable alternative to Hillary on foreign policy. It just seems to me that Trump is, and I'm shocked to hear myself say this, even scarier, you know?
Mm. Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely true that he doesn't have a fully coherent ideology on anything. So he hasn't been immersed in the policy details of, national governance through his career. When he's been in the political arena, he's been a pundit. So he's basically been running as a pundit rather than a policy impresario. And that has some undesirable effects. But I think, the case you just laid out there, in which I basically agree with, I think nevertheless highlights another fallacy of the prevailing liberal view of Trump, right? So people say he doesn't have beliefs on anything. He can't believe anything he says. He's self-contradictory and he hasn't thought anything out, which I think is, there's legitimacy to that objection. However, you'll then have liberals, generally, and some conservatives, but mostly liberals will latch on to some remark that he made that seems bigoted or seems incendiary against minorities, which is worthy of denunciation. But they'll latch on to that as indicative of his adherence to a racist worldview, right? Rather than just some kind of wisecrack. And I think a lot of it is probably wisecrack, and he probably has some kind of bigoted tendencies as would be observable among a lot of 70-year-old people, right? But it'll then be extrapolated from those wisecracks that he even is, in some cases, in terms of what some liberals say, an ideological white nationalist. That's a popular meme going around. Like, white nationalism is, most racists are not white nationalists, right? White nationalism is a specific ideology that is internally coherent. It's repugnant, but it's internally coherent. And a very small minority of people who actually, will research race theory and all those sorts of things devised that ideology. And to say that because Trump has made some kind of crude remarks about minorities, which again, I feel the need to qualify every remark like this, is wrong. To say that then means that he's some kind of ideological racist is a jump that I don't think is supportable.
Right, although I would feel more reassured on that front if, when they asked him about David Duke and the Ku Klux Klan, he just said, yeah, I disavow them, I don't want any part of them. And he was obviously playing it, he was trying to, have it both ways. Unless he genuinely did not know who David Duke was or something. And similarly, like, had he not hired this Bannon guy from Breitbart, which I mean, you'll have to admit that Breitbart, at the very least, has not tried to distance itself from white nationalism. That's, I think, the very mildest indictment we can agree on as far as
sure. Breitbart. But I love to point out that people forget this. I've been saying over and over again, at least when the Bannon hire was made. When was that? Late August. That in 2012, Mitt Romney's campaign officially partnered with Breitbart.com, which back then was just as
I don't know about that. Now Breitbart was still alive then, right?
No, he was dead. Breitbart had died.
Because I think Breitbart was not always as alt-right friendly. Well, the alt-right wasn't.
Well, there was
no
such thing as an alt-right.
I know. But still, I don't know.
But it germinated some of the most noxious anti-Obama conspiracy theories, that he was a stealth jihadist, that he was, working to undermine the American way of life from within. So all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, but let me put it this way. I think Breitbart was more neocon friendly then than it is now. And it's the move to white nationalism that I think is kind of decisive here. All the other stuff you mentioned, like Obama's a secret Muslim and stuff, it's not like neocons go around saying that, but that is not like opposed to their agenda. Mm-hmm. Whereas the other stuff, when you start going like white nationalist and anti-Semitic, that's when you start. It's going to be hard to hang on to your neocon constituency. And I think there has been that kind of break with Breitbart at some point since Breitbart himself died. And I have not traced the evolution. From my mind, it's always been like a stupid incendiary website. But
well, Breitbart died in early 2012, and then by the time the Romney campaign announced its partnership with Breitbart, Breitbart himself had been dead for several months. That's neither here nor there, really. I just wanted to complete the point that I was trying to make by even raising that in the first place, which is that so liberals will assign this ideological, coherent belief system to Trump based on fleeting comments that he might make, mm-hmm. right? But then they'll say you can't trust anything he says that he is even remotely resembling non-interventionism. So, you know, he has contradictory positions on American interventionism, but there is a way to read what he said over the years as indicating anti-interventionism in some maybe nationalistic form, but anti-interventionist nevertheless, or even on trade, right?
Right.
Going back to the 80s, he said that, you know, America is getting ripped off with its trade deals. There are quotes where you could see him opposing NAFTA in the early 90s. So there's some consistent through line there, right? But even then, on that, liberals will say you can't trust anything he said, but you can trust what he said on the things that seem repellent. So it just seems that there's an inconsistency there in the prevailing view of him that I think is not...
Yeah, no, there's all kinds of these consistencies out there that are easy to spot. I mean, easy to find because, you know, this is an election where pretty much all elites feel deeply engaged. They are in combat mode. So it's like you mentioned, like, well, was the Miss Universe thing really worth the trouble? Well, here's what was going on, right? Hillary had used the Miss Universe thing to seemingly devastating effect at the very end of that debate. So all the Hillary supporters, you know, wake up and wait, there's a mild problem with the narrative. This woman has a more complicated past. And they start worrying that that could undermine the strength of Hillary's use of the Miss Universe thing. And so then when Trump, bless his heart, spends the hours between 3 a.m. and 5:30 a.m. tweeting about Miss Universe, also feeding very nicely into incipient rumors about cocaine use, I might add. Naturally the pro-Hillary folks are going to exploit that. So all of this is completely intelligible. I mean, you're a lot younger than I am, and I remember when I was more outraged by hypocrisy than I am now, and I'm sure I'm too accepting of it now. But you're just going to find these kinds of logical. You know, when what we're seeing by and large is just a bunch of campaign rhetoric, you're going to see all of these logical contradictions, and you're going to see people failing to be consistent on, like, wait, is Trump just opportunistic or is he just ideological rather than picking and choosing, right? But now I will say that one thing that's new here is the extent to which liberal, you know, supposedly straight media, well, not liberal, mainstream supposedly straight media, like Washington Post, New York Times.
That are accused by conservatives of being liberal.
They're accused by conservatives of being liberal, but the truth is, like, the Washington Post editorial page is essentially neocon and...
Establishmentarian.
Yeah, I just think they are the establishment, and what's new is they seem to be all in, pretty much all in against Trump. And so this kind of campaign mode analysis, I would say, has reached higher levels of the elite media structure than you normally see. That's new.
Yeah, I'm glad you raised that point, because it's funny, I went to go watch the first debate between Trump and Hillary with this group of New Jersey Republicans who had gathered. Watch the debates with different groups of people. So, you know, at the vice presidential debate this past week, I went to watch with this group of affluent Democrats. And it's funny, the most enthusiastic Hillary supporters are overwhelmingly women age 50 and over and gay men of all ages. So they're the types who will populate a Hillary watch party, at least. But, you know, on the drive home from that the event last week for the Trump-Hillary event, NPR had this post-debate show on. And one of the callers was a Trump supporter who called in and accused one of the hosts of being biased against Trump. Mm-hmm. And, you know, normally that's something that an NPR host would just be horrified to hear, right? Or at least prior to this cycle. But the NPR host, and I can't recall the guy's name right now, but he freely admitted, yes, I'm against Trump. And, like, that's a sea change in the media.
The overtness is a sea change. The adjectives, the New York Times used the word lie in a headline. Like, what was, did you see that? It was a week or two ago. It was like Trump... Oh, it was the birther thing. Trump blank his birther lie. And, you know, strictly speaking, a lie is when you know it's untrue when you say it. And so strictly speaking, it's actually very hard to know when someone is lying. And traditionally, that's the kind of boundary that the elite media, like the New York Times, respected. But the gloves are off.
And NPR, I was listening, I guess, the week prior, and some other hosts just straight up called Trump a liar just in one of the news programs. So, you know, I think actually that's salutary in some ways. I think it's a good development that these people are more willing to state their honest beliefs about political figures now. I don't really have any conviction or I don't have any belief really that it'll continue in the future post-Trump were he to lose. But I think, you know, one unintended negative consequence of all this is that the total elite unity against Trump has created these blind spots about Trump that, you know, a more self-conscious, self-aware elite would be at least working to remediate in some ways or to account for, you know, but I don't feel, you know, but the groupthink and the universal opposition and loathing of him, I think, has really caused a situation, whereas this echo chamber, and echo chamber is kind of a trite way to put it, but it really is an echo chamber of just elites spouting their outrage at one another with no expectation that they're going to encounter another elite who has a sympathetic view of Trump. So, of course, that's going to create some kind of, a situation where whatever the prevailing elite view is seen as unassailably correct and right and virtuous. And I don't think that's a healthy dynamic.
Yeah, and what... I mean, for my part, I'll say I kind of respect the basic instinct here, which is people think the Republic is actually endangered. I don't think that's a completely crazy way to look at Trump. I think there are scary forces that he would exacerbate. So I'm not necessarily condemning the sense of, I guess you could say, patriotism that leads these people into action. I do think it can have long-term downsides to, but anyway, that aside, what do you think? I think early on you said that the outrage against Trump among elites is dangerous. And I assume, is it the case that one of the things you have in mind is that we are failing to understand some things about what motivates Trumpism that it would be in our interest to understand? I mean, you did a piece for, I think it was the Daily Beast where it was about the mainstream media's blind spot.
Yeah,
about just you know, listing these treating Trump supporters like as if they're animals in a zoo, mm-hmm. Rather than I don't know, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but would it behoove us to better comprehend the root causes of this whole thing?
Yeah, and I think, you know, there have been some attempts to understand the root causes of Trumpism to the extent that there's a backlash to that endeavor on the part of liberals who will say that it's totally unwarranted to suggest that anything about why Trumpism is popular is based on economic concerns or so forth. It's totally pure racism. That's a strain of thinking among the liberal commentariat that, you know, there's actually excessive inquiry into the roots of Trumpism at the expense of acknowledging what is just plain old-fashioned racism that has boosted him. So, I mean, so if that's the view you want to adopt, that would mean that probably 60 million people who are going to be voting for Trump in November, win or lose, are just what, unabashed racists, or at least half
are in the basket of deplorables.
Right. So at least half are deplorable. You know, it's funny, you know, Tim Kaine at the debate this week basically gave the impression that Hillary had withdrawn that basket of deplorables comment. Mm-hmm. And what she really did was clarify it, saying...
Well, she withdrew the half part, which was good.
Yeah, but I mean, classifying it as half was the whole point of the statement.
No, look, I agree. I mean, in a way, here's what bothers me about that, is it's, let's assume that half of them were racist. Even if they were, racism doesn't appear out of nowhere. I mean, I would still want to understand what it came from, in other words. I would still ask, well, what conditions inclined them in this direction? Whereas her framework seemed to be, like half of these people, there's just no point in thinking about them, you know?
Yeah.
I think there's a point in thinking about everybody and what motivates their behavior, but go ahead.
Yeah, I think, you know, part of what that statement revealed about Hillary's political instincts is that she feels it's somehow worthwhile to simply heap contempt on people. Somehow that's politically advantageous to her, rather than, I think, what is Obama's instinct, which is to grok what is motivating those people. Mm-hmm. So she doesn't feel that's a worthwhile endeavor to engage in this kind of, I guess you could say, you know, Marxist-oriented analysis, which is to try to understand the underlying dynamics, right, which give rise to that, you know, tendency. But
and in fact, by the way, in Obama's famous bitterly clinging to guns and religion remark, it was explanatory. It was analytical. He was explaining why they're like this. But Hillary was dividing her basket into racists. No point in explaining them. And then the other people, she actually explained, like, what are the root causes of why they support Trump. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. I'm trying to think. What was the... You asked...
Well, it's just like, what root causes are we failing to think about to our...
You know, I think a lot of this inability to comprehend the so-called root causes of what animates Trumpism stems from the fact that people in elite spheres who are based... The ones tasked with understanding that, you know, sensibility don't have anybody in their cohort who shares what, you know, is popularly conceived of as Trumpism, right? So I don't assign blame to any individual in that elite cohort necessarily, but just as a group, they aren't exposed to it on a regular basis. So they have no firsthand experiential data from which to draw to try to develop a picture of what this support consists of. So in order to get any kind of sense of it, they have to go out and do these kind of like exotic expeditions, which kind of inherently leads to distorted analysis, right? Because, you know, whereas I think if you had people who emerge from those circles doing the analysis, you get a more accurate depiction of it. So it flows from just the cloistered nature of American elite mm-hmm. communities more so than any particular failing of a particular elite.
So even if the common view, what I take to be the common view among many Trump supporters, that elites have contempt for them, even if that's overstated, you're saying elites have in effect walled themselves off and ceased to, you know, they do not grasp what's going on in Trumpland.
No, that results in this, you know, predilection to view Trump support. So the Trump supporter is now this construct, right? No longer are the people that, you know, are in everybody's everyday life who you pass by on the street or you might, you know, run into at the corner deli or whatnot. They're this anthropological phenomenon that needs to be assessed, mm-hmm. you know, whereas, you know, that's 60 million people. So it's like, I don't think anybody consciously walled themselves off. I just think the walls were erected and they have no ability to
At the same time, I mean, I kind of feel somewhat indicted myself by your remarks, because I think I'm trying to understand them, and I admit it takes a little work because they're clearly not exactly like me, and maybe it sometimes seems like I'm treating them like, you know, visitors from another planet or something.
The funny thing is, so the most people who will vote for Trump in November also voted for Romney in 2012, right? But there wasn't this anthropological phenomenon known as the Romney supporter in 2012. It's a lot of the same people.
Yeah, well, Romney wasn't as weird as Trump.
Yeah, but they're the same people, so it's like...
But they weren't responding to the same message. They weren't... You know, there weren't... We're running out of time. But, I mean, there weren't, like, rallies where fights were breaking out. Romney wasn't encouraging to hit protesters and so on.
Let me tell you, Bob, I went to Romney general election rallies in 2012. There were people spouting the most, you know, odious conspiracy theories that you could ever see at a Trump rally now. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't elevated as this some kind of, like, stark, meaningful event. Mm-hmm. It was just seen as, like, kind of normal, standard fare American politics. But now, everything associated with Trump, even the banal aspects... Or the expected aspects of, you know, what the Republican nominee would, what kind of forces would be underlying the Republican nominee's candidacy, even those now are treated as this kind of exotic manifestation in the universe of something we've never seen before. So there's, I don't think, again, it's another contradiction, another incoherent way of looking at it.
I would argue that this is a little different from what we've seen, and in some respects in alarming ways. But the final question, would you rather see Trump win the election than Hillary? And if so, that's the end of the question. If not, do you worry that the effect of your online activities and so on, the drift of the things you write and so on, will tend to make it more likely that Trump will win?
You know, I get that as pushback to a lot of what I do in one variation or another. I've basically resisted the unending choir of people demanding that I answer that question or that I make an endorsement or something along those lines, right? Because I don't feel it's incumbent on me to do so, really. I mean, I feel like my personal preference isn't, you know, my analysis doesn't necessarily have to hinge on what my personal preference for an outcome is. You know, that being said, I do think it's a legitimate question to ask. And I think the foreign policy issue is what gives me the most pause about it. Because I don't know. I mean, I think there's a chance.
The most pause about Trump?
Gives me pause about, you know, whether I would prefer one over another. So I think if you limit the analysis solely to foreign policy, which you can't do. I mean, so it doesn't exist in a vacuum. But, like, you know, for the sake of argument, I don't know with enough degree of certainty to say that one will be worse than other to say who I would prefer. I think there's a decent chance that Trump could be substantially better than Hillary on foreign policy. He could also be dramatically worse. Whereas Hillary is guaranteed to just be a worse iteration of what the status quo is, right? So, you know, given that level of uncertainty, I don't feel I have enough... I don't feel I'm equipped to answer the question, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not going to be voting for Trump. I'm not going to be voting for Hillary. I mean, so that's what I'll tell people.
Okay.
In terms of what outcome is preferable, on foreign policy in particular, and, you know, I like to style myself as a foreign policy voter because there aren't enough around.
That's for sure.
I feel like I want to prioritize that in my comparative assessment of the candidates. So, you know, using that as a framework, I don't know. I'm not confident enough one way or another to say what I prefer. I'm just kind of – I want to be – have humility about it and say I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and, domestically – you know, Hillary obviously faked her opposition to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I think that's obvious.
Yeah.
Whereas Trump, you know, as I mentioned before, one of the few things that he has been consistent about over the years is his opposition to these mammoth corporatized trade deals. And he's, you know, campaigned on his opposition to TPP from the outset. So if that's what you care about, I don't understand. I mean, I'm not weighing in definitively either way. But if that's really what you care about, I don't see how you can necessarily say that Trump supporting Trump is totally untenable, unless there's some other factor which makes it untenable, such as his crude remarks or bigoted remarks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's funny, you mentioned, you know, there are some remaining white working class people and union members still in the Democratic Party coalition. And I've been looking at this literature that the Teamsters have sent out to their membership recently, you know, voter guides and, you know, the dictates from Hoffa, who's still the president. And, you know, in the most recent communication, Hoffa, you know, writes a message to the members, and he addresses the presidential election specifically, but he doesn't mention either candidate. All he does is mention the union's opposition to TPP. And, you know, the Teamsters have formally endorsed Clinton, but the fact that they're omitting any mention of her in their official election materials, I think, is interesting and maybe indicative of some kind of split within their membership.
Yeah, well, as I said, I think the Democratic Party faces issues.
Yeah.
So, well, thank you. Thanks for taking the time. Where can people find you on Twitter?
Yeah, it's M as in Michael, Tracy, one word, MTRACEY.
All right. Well, thank you, and maybe we'll check back in with you later as things develop, and we'll be reading you until then. We'll link to your stuff. By the way, we should also link to this Stephen Walt piece arguing that Hillary might not be as hawkish as people fear. I'm not sure I'm persuaded, but it's
me neither.
Yeah, but it's out there. Okay, well, thank you, Michael.
Okay, sounds good.
All right.
Enjoy it, Bob.
Take care.
Okay.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.